This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Cedarside. Cedarside's original 100% organic insect spray kills bed bugs, mosquitoes, fleas, ticks, mites, scorpions, roaches, and more, but is completely safe for your home, pets, and family. Go to cedarside.com, use coupon code Hoffman at checkout for free shipping, or call 800-842-1464 and mention you heard it here. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to deviate from our usual subjects of diet, exercise, supplements, big medicine, environmental health problems. We are going to talk about big medicine, because that's the title of a book that we're about to discuss with Dr. Elena George. Dr. George is an ear, nose, and throat specialist practicing in Atlanta, Georgia, and she has a very interesting perspective on what's happening in medicine, because it is her belief that big insurance, big pharma, and now big medicine are depriving citizens of their right to choose and are narrowing the options available to citizens of the United States. And I'll let her share her perspective on this with you. The book is Big Medicine. Dr. Elena George, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about yourself and how you arrived at this perspective, because you're on the front lines of medicine. You do ENT, mm-hmm. medicine in Atlanta, Georgia. Are you working in a hospital, or are you a private practitioner?
I'm one of the few solo practitioners out there. It's a dwindling group, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah, indeed. You know, that is a kind of a grievous phenomenon in American medicine, because people tend to think, well, I've got my doctor, and I go to his or her office, and I have a one-on-one experience. But that is a dwindling type of situation. So what's happening to the lone wolf primary care practitioner in America?
Well, I think briefly we're being forced out of business. And it's been an ongoing process. I graduated in 1998 and opened my practice in 2001 after working for a very large specialty group. And every year, and I'm sure you know this, the reimbursements have dropped and have just become so hard to stay open, practice medicine, and make payroll that doctors have been forced to look for other alternatives. And one of the main things that doctors are doing is they're joining and becoming members of hospitals, and they're going on payroll, because it's much easier to get a payroll than it is to try to navigate this healthcare system. And we're losing people to retirement early, we're losing people to leaving medicine altogether, and we're losing people to these types of systems where choice and individualized patient care gets sacrificed on the altar of the, you know, too big to fail phenomenon.
Yeah, so, you know, actually, I recently had a reunion with my medical school alumni, and you know, the good medical school, and you know, some real top people who are really mm-hmm. excellent in their various chosen fields, whether it's cardiology or oncology, you know, ophthalmology, radiology, and you know, I kind of went around talking to these people, and I said, you know, do you still enjoy medicine? And many of them said, yes, I still enjoy medicine. I'm glad I made the choice, but. And mm-hmm. then the complaints came. I've had to lose a lot of autonomy, because originally I started out in private practice, but I had to sell to the hospital. I sold my practice, and now I'm an employee of the hospital, and it's okay, but. And then they, you know, unleashed a series of laments about how medicine has changed. Is this something that you encounter when you socialize with your colleagues?
Absolutely. It's the number one topic. And now under the Affordable Care Act, it's actually gotten worse, where the hospitals are consumed with coding properly, with billing properly, with documentation. And it's not about the patient care. I just read an interesting letter to the editor of CIRMO about how inpatient care was not the same. I saw that. I've worked in the hospital setting, and it's become call a consult just because, you know, because you want to document and get another charge mm-hmm. for the hospital. So I, you know, for example, being called to take out earwax on an inpatient, and you ask them, did they look, and they tell you they don't have an otoscope. I mean, things like that, wow. that's going to cost the patient hundreds of dollars.
So in other words, this would be a routine thing that, you know, this is something that, you know, any well-trained physician can do. It's a basic exactly. primary care procedure. And yet they will call in a specialist increasingly mm-hmm. to do anything that's just slightly outside their boundary zone.
Exactly. And the hospital gets to bill for it because it's a consult. So, I mean, there's all sorts of things that have gone on in the healthcare system. And the reason that I wrote the book, I'm going to be clear, it's not a political book. It's about education. I don't think doctors or patients really know what happened over the past 10 to 15 years. I'm fortunate or unfortunate because I saw both ends of this. When I graduated in 1998, it was the beginning of HMO and capitation. And, you know, having to go through gatekeepers and having the insurance companies gain a tremendous amount of power on what doctors were allowed to do. And it's gotten worse under the Obamacare system.
So explain, you know, you threw out some terms there, capitation, H&R. Mm-hmm. You know, what's up with that? How does this affect the individual patient?
Well, let's talk about the patient. If you have a problem that happens to be an ENT problem, for example, you have to go to your primary care physician. And they have to send a requisition or request for the ENT doctor to see you. If you go directly to the ENT doctor and bypass the primary care doctor, you won't have your insurance company cover it. So they're acting
Wait a minute, Dr. George. I got a terrible earache. I know what's wrong with me. Or I've got a bout of a horrible sinusitis, and I can't get rid of it. And I know that I need to see the ENT. Yet I still need to make a pit stop at the at the internist's office, the primary care doctor's office, often where you probably see, at this point, a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. And then they'll just nod their head and say, yes, I agree. You need, now that you've waited 2 days for an appointment to see me or a week or more, now you can go make your appointment with the ENT, who might be booked through, you know, next October.
you basically summed it up very well. But you know what? It may not be 2 days. It may be we have to treat you with X number of antibiotics before. We can send you. So you end up actually being sicker longer. Maybe something that was routine becomes complex. And patients are really unhappy about this. This ended in 2001 when people were up in arms about this system. They didn't like it when it came around the first time. And they're using the same template with the Affordable Care Act, where now with this newest iteration of it, it's called HR2, that was a supposed doc fix that we all know about. They created something called the Accountable Care Organization as a measure of controlling costs. And what it is HMOs on steroids. So mm-hmm. now you have the government deciding to pay a certain amount of money to a consortium, a doctor, hospital, and all the primary care pieces that go into the hospital delivery system. Well, the delivery system gets the money. And they keep that money and make a profit based on how much care they give.
They make a profit on how little care they give because the
Correct.
Incentive is to provide less care. That I think that has something to do with capitation. In other words, it means there's a ceiling or a max. I mean, I know this from baseball. You know, there's capitation, I think, in Major League Baseball. Excuse me. That you get the salary cap, and that's it. That's as much as you can charge. And
Correct.
Then you have to, given those resources, spread those resources as thin as possible among all the patients that you see.
That's exactly right. And you're now seeing the growth of telemedicine coming out of this. So now patients are being treated remotely because it's cheaper to keep them out of the brick-and-mortar office where you have to use supplies and time. And this is now the next thing coming online. So now we have medicine moving towards an individualized doctor-patient relationship-driven system to one that's central, one that's controlled by cost, and it's not the doctor-patient driving this anymore.
And indeed, so what else, in the day-to-day life of a doctor who's working with insurance companies, I mean, the whole idea is the patient doesn't see the cost. I mean, it's all basically free or highly subsidized care. But ultimately, there's a huge burden on the physician to provide the paperwork, the diagnostic codes, to get mm-hmm. on the phone, to schmooze with the insurance companies, to get pre-approvals. Then you prescribe a drug. Then they tell you that drug's not available. Doctor, could you please prescribe another drug? Is it okay? Why aren't you prescribing a cheaper generic? Isn't that kind of like about, you know, 60% of the time of somebody who takes insurance these days?
Oh, absolutely. Maybe 70%. And there is a change now. What you just described is what happened before the Affordable Care Act. Now, since it's come online and it's actually being implemented, the patients now are actually on the hook for a lot more of the healthcare dollar cost than they were before. So when I opened my practice in 2001, a patient who had insurance, they'd present their insurance card, maybe they had a $10 copay that they had to pay out of pocket, and they were good to go. Now people are coming in having to pay $2,500, $5,000. I had a patient come in having to pay $10,000 out of pocket before the insurance kicked in the first dollar. So the cost shifting has gone to the patient.
But that would be the middle class patient, isn't it? Because the patients it's not applicable to, it's still applicable to even like patients who are getting like minimal coverage from Obamacare. Don't they get a lot of free services?
No, they might get free services, and that means just a bare minimum.
Yeah.
Maybe a mammogram, a colonoscopy. But when it comes down to routine care, coming in with a head cold, with sinus mm-hmm. infection, that's not being paid for. And I can tell you personally that we've seen some Affordable Care Act patients who came in. We got a pre-certification to do whatever we needed to do. And after the fact, we got letters saying that it was not medically necessary and it wasn't covered, or it was experimental. So they pulled the rug out from both the doctor and the patient after the fact. And
wow.
Consequently, we no longer take Obamacare.
So it's sort of capricious and unreliable. It makes it tough for the doctor to partner with a system like that, because you never know when your next paycheck is coming. It may come months later, years later, when they finally decide. Or not at all. Yeah. Devil's advocate argument, you know, is that we needed in America some kind of cost containment system. For want of a better initiative, we passed ACA, Obamacare, ACA, whatever you want to call it. And the idea was to throttle down some of our healthcare costs because clearly that was going to sink our national budget. You know, we have entitlements, we have Medicare, we have Medicaid. And the therapies that we offer are ever more expensive, ever more sophisticated. So won't there be cost containment coming down the line one way or the other?
If the cost containment that's going to come is by denial of care, either self-denial because the patient can't afford to come and be seen or have the test done, or after the fact when the insurance company denies it out of hand. So my argument, or the gist of the arc of the book, is that we pick the wrong group to decide how to fix the affordable or how to fix our healthcare problem. We use the people who really are not on the front line, who don't have skin in the game in the sense of the doctor-patient working together to get the patient better. We have the gatekeepers. We have the administrators who are deciding what happens with the healthcare dollar. Do you realize that only 7 cents of every dollar goes to the doctor? The rest of it's in administration. That's unacceptable. And now we have the patient literally on the hook for paying more money out of pocket and yet getting less care, but they're told to like it. And that's where, if you have an understanding of how it came to be, you can actually figure out what's going to work for you. I'm not against Obamacare, all right? It's here to stay. It's the law of the land. I understand that. Everything that we tried to do to stop it, it didn't work. But I think that people need to understand that they don't have to be in that system, that there are ways around the system that works for the individual patient. If you want it, you can have it. If you don't, there's a lot of things that you can do that are actually that are available now that no one ever talks about that could save you a ton of money, where you could actually see a doctor now and actually afford to do so, where your privacy won't be preempted by the electronic medical record system, which I believe is a real encroachment on patient privacy. All those things, we can just make choices.
And I want to get to that in just a few moments. So we usually divide these podcasts into two parts. And in part two, I want to talk about your proposed solutions, because it's not enough to decry the situation as it is. We need to come up with constructive answers. I think that's part of the problem with our current political process. We have a lot of politicians criticizing things. But then in terms of positive initiatives, they come up short. So, but continuing on the theme of what's wrong with our current healthcare system, you know, when the ACA or Obamacare was created, Big Pharma was brought in. They signed off on it. Big Insurance was brought in. They signed off on it too. I always say, you know, when something happens, follow the money trail. Has this been a bonanza for the pharmaceutical industry and for insurance companies?
Oh my goodness, you absolutely correct on that statement. I say it too. They made out like bandits with it. Remember, it's a mandate. So the government is mandating that you buy health insurance. And that means they have willing or captive audience. You have to buy from them. And what they've managed to do, if you notice how this is moving, we had dozens of insurance companies over the past several years. We're now down to effectively to three throughout the entire country. Because
so
they realize
competition is out the window, diversity is out the window, choice is out the window.
That's right, and they can control costs. And I'll give you an example. Blue Cross just annexed Cigna, and there was a letter that they wrote that I read stating that they now have, quote, leverage to negotiate with physicians. You know what that means? That means they get to decide how much they pay you, how much what gets covered, and you better like it because there's nothing else in town. Yep. That's what leverage really means.
It's the only game in town, yeah.
Correct.
And what for Big Pharma, this has meant more patients who need to be on statins, who need to be on anti-anxiety, antidepressant medications, bone-enhancing medications. These were the underserved population who now can be placed on lifelong medical prescriptions, which are a huge subsidy to the pharmaceutical industry.
Oh, it's definitely a great payout. There's one other thing that the Affordable Care Act does, and that if you have a health savings account, you can only use that to buy brand name prescription drugs. You can't use it to buy toothpaste or supplements. So for those who have a question as to what you said is true, they need to know that. That's a definite windfall for them.
Exactly. You know, I really like the idea of health savings accounts because it gives people choice about, you know, their medical decisions. And I really had wished that we were going to expand them instead of contract them under Obamacare. But they're virtually being pushed out of existence. And a medical savings account, you could be allocated towards acupuncture. It could be allocated towards perhaps even exercise classes. Healthful activities that might actually have a more substantial impact on a person's well-being than strictly taking a pharmaceutical drug.
Oh, if only it were like that. You know, I thought that health savings accounts were an answer too, but I'm living them now as a doctor, having patients come in with the health savings account. They're really not all that they're cracked up to be, because they are still controlled by the insurance company. If it's not approved as an insurance allowable item, you cannot use your health savings account to pay for it. And to me, that's the ultimate betrayal. If they're telling you that you can do whatever you want with your money, yet when you really need to use it, you can only use it for what they say you can, then that's not what the health savings account should be about. People need to understand that.
It's a movement away from freedom and more towards centralization and government directives.
I think there's no question. It's about, and I've written about this in various blogs, that Obamacare was not about health care. It was about control. Control of 1/6 of the economy, control of how you spend your health care dollar, control of from the doctor, what the doctor's allowed, how the doctor's allowed to treat you. And we don't talk about the nuts and bolts, and patients don't know this. It's kind of inside baseball. But when you go to a hospital and you get admitted, you're a Medicare patient, for example, if you get readmitted within 30 days with the same diagnosis, the hospital will not be paid. The Medicare won't pay for it, and it becomes your bill. I mean, that's something that patients have no clue about. Wow. And that's under the Affordable Care Act. Yeah, that's tragic, isn't it?
That is huge. And I mean, there's so many, there's, you know, it's kind of like we have to pass the bill to find out what's in it. Well, it's taken us years to begin to, you know, this is a huge document, almost, you know, completely resistant to sitting down and analyzing it in one gulp. But all the ramifications and all the policies that now have been fleshed out because they're not specified, this is, you know, continues to have ramifications. Talk to me about IPAB, you know, not iPad, IPAB, IPAB. What is IPAB and why should we be concerned about it?
Well, it's a non-elected appointed body.
It stands for what? Independence?
Payment Advisory Board.
Board, yeah, thank you. Okay, it's an acronym for a centralized group of experts, not necessarily doctors, but experts who will decide on whether, let's take an example, whether it's a good idea to do knee replacements on patients with osteoarthritis. I mean, that would be an example of a type of therapy that might be disallowed or allowed based on a decree by this panel.
That's correct, and they do not have to be physicians. And they are not even healthcare practitioners, right? So they're bean counters, essentially. I think a really good example of this was Dr. Berwick, who was the head of Medicare and Medicaid services for a while. And he spoke about this at length, about how it should fall to the people, basically, I'm going to paraphrase, but the bureaucrats, to decide who and what gets covered. And they've already put this into play in Arizona. There was Medicare stopped covering Avastin for uterine cancer because it was felt that it didn't help enough people, it was too costly, so it wasn't worth it to cover it. And that's what happens. They're deciding based on cost, not on patients, not on what the doctor and patient need. If you fall into a category, then you're not likely to get much benefit because of your age, because of the disease you have, things that are really just group of population-based medicine, okay,
right.
Not individualized care.
And this kind of brings up the specter of what was once luridly termed death panels. You know, it's perhaps, you know, a little bit overdramatic to say that certain people are being triaged by the system. Mm-hmm. But in England, they call this comparable system NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Evaluation, I think, which is, that's not a great acronym. It's nice. But it's not so nice when you're the patient who is denied care because you're too old, too sick, or they think you're at the end of the line.
I think you're absolutely right. And I love how they come up with these acronyms that sound so benign. Just look up the Liverpool Care Pathway, which is part of NICE, part of the UK National Health Service, where they were denying water and food to patients as a form of euthanasia. Oof. I mean, this is not about being a sensationalist. This is the truth, and this is part of their system. And in the Canadian system, they talked about withholding food and water from neonates who they felt were not viable after they were born. So this is it's a ghoulish system, and I believe that it works against the Hippocratic Oath. I took the initial Hippocratic Oath where I was not allowed to perform euthanasia, where the patient's good was the paramount reason that you treat somebody. And that's gone now. I mean, under this system, it's about money. It's not about healthcare. And they're about keeping, you know, deciding who lives and who dies, honestly.
Well, on that somber note, let's pause because we usually divide these podcasts into two parts. We've covered a lot of what's wrong with our current healthcare system, and it looming ahead is a worsening of the situation as provisions of the Affordable Care Act, another euphemism, get implemented in years to come. We'll talk to our guest, Dr. Elena George, about some possible solutions. She has them in her book called Big Medicine. Dr. George, you got a website for our listeners?
Yes, they can reach me at drelenageorge.com. That's E-L-A-I-N-A, George like the man's name.
drelenageorge.com. The book is
correct.
Big Medicine. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we'll be right back with part two of today's interview. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.